This is Block by Block, a community news program from WPPMLP 106.5 FM, where we explore issues affecting the Philadelphia area with news reports from members of the community. I'm David Chaney Jr.
And I'm Jen DeVore. In the next half hour, we'll hear stories from our community news reporters about some of the safety risks facing journalists, the impact of endometriosis on Black women, and the role midwives and doulas play in the Black community.
But first, Philadelphia has struggled with littering and illegal dumping for a long time. Mayor Sherelle Parker made a campaign promise to clean up our neighborhoods when she ran for office last year. And now that she's mayor, she's laid out her plans for doing that. But Block by Block reporter Oscar Castro spoke with an expert who thinks the city could be doing more.
Nick Esposito worked for Mayor Jim Kenney for 4 years as the city's zero waste and litter director, focusing on keeping the city clean from waste and litter. He also started a company called Circa Technologies, aiming to change how people shop and reduce waste. Additionally, Nick helps lead Circular Philadelphia, a group working to make our local economy better by recycling more and reusing things. His job is to figure out what's stopping us from doing this and to push for new ways to make it happen. Nick recently wrote an article for the Philadelphia Citizen with his thoughts on Mayor Parker's plan to address litter and dumping in the city as laid out in her first budget proposal. I recently spoke with Nick to delve deeper into the topic.
Litter begets litter. When people see dirtier spaces, they tend to litter more in them. It's just this natural thing. Humans don't tend to like go litter in places that are pristine and look really nice. You know, I heard another radio program where they were talking about this. They had an official from the city on. And this very strange equation with like poverty equals littering. And they're almost saying, well, if people are poor, we're not saying why exactly. We're just kind of generally vaguely connecting the two, that they're going to litter more. And I don't believe that is the case at all in my long-term experience of dealing with litter. What I do look at is places that are disinvested in, where you have a lot of vacant lots, empty buildings. You're not getting city services. You tend not to make a lot of headway or make good decisions when you're constantly just reacting to things. You're not planning for things. You're not trying to think through, okay, what are the longer-term outcomes? What's the longer-term implications of what I'm doing right now? And this budget represented that. It's investing a lot of money in just cleaning up immediately litter that's on our streets and dumping that's happening without really asking and investing in the longer term strategies of like, well, why are people dumping? Like, again, getting past that Philly shrug, like, well, people just dump. That's how it is in Philly. We should just keep cleaning it up. I'm really trying to show that that's never going to work. The biggest things I saw in the budget that really concerned me is reacting to these problems. And I think anybody knows, whether you're talking about the whole host of things that I think people can connect to in their daily lives, you might clean up something for that day. And everyone in Philly knows who's ever done a cleanup, who's ever just swept their street up. It's back days later. So if you're not investing in solving the problems of why it's actually happening, you're going to keep spending a lot of money. And it's both money and time that we don't have in Philadelphia. And we have to be as smart as possible with these investments we're making now. And I just don't think this budget does that. They created this clean and green cabinet that they've just announced. They've talked about it generally or vaguely. They put somebody in place to that position, which I was very vocal about, Carlton Williams, who has been the person who's been in the positions that have supposed to clean the city up, supposed to pick our trash up as the streets commissioner through sanitation, and has failed on so many levels that it is kind of inconceivable to me that he would be selected to run the clean and green cabinet. But with that, who's on the clean and green cabinet? What is it going to do? How's it going to function? None of that information is put out there. It's really great to see Mayor Parker willing to spend, because when I was in city government, that was a big thing around the Kenney administration. And as I also said in the Citizen article, I remember it was this big leap that we were going to have to spend maybe like $15, $20 million on all the equipment and then $6 million a year on staff to street sweep. Parker is talking about like $30 million a year just to street sweep. And that's like, how did it go from 5 to 6 million that we couldn't afford to now it's 30 million? Like, it doesn't make any sense. It's like, let's spend the 5 million street sweeping while we're spending maybe that other 25 million in more L&I inspectors to better, you know, regulate the trash industry, better, you know, equipment and ways that we pick up trash in the streets department.
Nick suggests that the city could improve its waste management by utilizing technology and data. This could help decide how trash gets collected from bins and what types of bins are needed in different areas. For instance, using sensors could alert sanitation workers when public bins are full, preventing them from overflowing.
Another thing that she talked about, Mayor Parker, 1,200 Big Bellies they want to put out. Yeah, the Big Bellies are great because they compact and all that, but you can get a similar technology. So rather than investing $5,000 in a Big Belly, get a bunch of wire baskets out there, put in, you know, very easy to kind of like hide little optical scanners, have them all throughout the city and actually use the technology. The crazy thing about the Big Bellies, they don't even use the technology on them downtown with the streets department. They basically just don't use the technology and they just ride the same routes over and over, or they respond to complaints, which again is that reactive thinking. Another piece is holding landlords responsible. The other misconception that I've heard is people say, oh, renters, they litter more. They put their trash out in worst ways because they don't care. They're not homeowners. Homeowners care more. As I've seen from data from the litter index that we used to do that isn't really done anymore in the city, it's not that it's about renters versus homeowners. It's about where you have landlords who actually go the extra mile to like get rental licenses to provide trash storage for the people living in their spaces. That's the bigger problem. So holding landlords more accountable, because we have, for the first time in the city's history, about 5 years ago, we are a majority renter city now, or majority like multi-unit, as opposed to majority homeowner, which we were for a long time. So we need to recognize that there's a lot of renters in this city. And again, depending on where you are, there's varying degrees of landlords. To the city of Philadelphia, like, listen to some of us, like work with us and make better decisions so we can actually achieve those goals.
You can learn more about Nick's work with Circular Philadelphia to address the root causes of our litter and trash problem at circularphiladelphia.org. I'm Oscar Castro for Block by Block.
Truthful, accurate, and fair news reporting is important because it helps people stay informed about what's happening in the world and in our communities. But there can be risks that come with documenting real events. Block by Block reporter Shania Weich brings us this story about some of the risks that journalists face and strategies for staying safe while reporting the news.
Journalists often find themselves in dangerous situations. During Black Lives Matter protests in the summer of 2020, I read numerous reports on police detaining and attacking journalists. In the past 7 months, Palestinian advocacy groups and news articles have reported that nearly 100 journalists have faced persecution while on the front lines of covering the war in Gaza. Although two very different scenarios, the risks of reporting are clear. In an effort to learn more about the risk of being a journalist, I interviewed Nadine Hoffman, Deputy Executive Director of the International Women's Media Foundation, also known as IWMF. The IWMF's mission is to advance women and non-binary journalists around the world with education on equity, opportunity, recognition, and safety.
We started doing this work a little over a decade ago. We were running international reporting fellowships to bring international journalists into some pretty difficult places. So, for example, Eastern Congo, the Central African Republic, South Sudan, and some of the places in Latin America like Mexico, Honduras, El Salvador. Places where, you know, there are a wide range of risks. And so at that time, we started offering hostile environment trainings for all the journalists who were going to participate in our programs. We were also running local programs in those countries. So we were working with both international journalists and then local journalists.
The IWMF has offered training in the United States with the focus on small and regional newsrooms that may not have the resources to hire security professionals. Nadine further mentions that assessing risk prior to an assignment is key for journalists when making a safety plan.
The core element is risk assessment, taking the time before assignments to really think through what are the potential threats, like who could potentially harm you and what would be the impact of that. It could be everything from you publish a story about a school board meeting and you receive a lot of online trolling, or it could be anything up to doxing where somebody is publishing your personal data. It could also be, as we talk a lot about in our trainings, civil unrest or protest. And we have seen that happen around election times before. So we anticipate that that could be one of the threats that journalists will face again, either in the lead up to elections or after the elections take place this year. One tactic we've seen that I think is really an intimidation tactic has been at big rallies where journalists are sort of put in a press pen where they're in one area that they aren't allowed to leave. And that makes them really sitting ducks. And politicians have, in fact, heckled them from the stage and encouraged the crowd to heckle them as well. And then the problem you can have with that is that as soon as those journalists walk outside to their cars, they could be followed by people who are angry at the media, and they could easily take down a license number or harass them. In terms of law enforcement, it is specific on the context of the place. And I don't think we can sort of say as a whole, this is the way law enforcement is treating journalists. But what we have seen is that in some places, there seems to be a much more aggressive approach that local law enforcement is taking with journalists. And I think it's also important to note there is really a difference that we're hearing in terms of the race of the journalists. Black journalists are facing more harassment and being targeted more by police than their white colleagues are, based on what we're hearing from journalists. So one other thing that we heard in Georgia from a Latina journalist who reports on the Latina community there is that she's often harassed and asked for her papers when she's covering immigration stories. She's harassed by local, you know, officials and law enforcement. So that's just another example of how people's identities are being used against them by people with authority.
In March, I spent some time in a training hosted by the IWMF on newsroom safety across America. Safety trainer and freelance journalist Roseanne Morton educated on how someone's profile can compromise a reporter's safety and gave some insight into her own personal experience.
There's a lot of like safety things in general that we think about, right? What is the size of the city you're staying in? Small, medium, large, like that affects your safety. Are you traveling by yourself? It sounded like a couple people here at Introductions travel by themselves. How high your profile is or how low your profile is, are you planning to blend in? Everyone's safety is different, especially for your own personal profile. So sometimes it works for you to be higher profile. Sometimes it works for you to be more low profile. And sometimes you physically just can't. Like if I am going to a place where it's a majority white space and I'm the only brown person there, there's like absolutely no way I could be low profile. But how can I maybe lean into my high profile that can lend me to be a bit more safe? I think just thinking about the clothing you wear is just really, really important. Like I had one of my colleagues who does this training, you know, she's a person of color who covers a lot of like pro-Trump rallies. She's also a veteran, so she would just wear a veteran hat. And in that way, you know, you're not hiding that you're a journalist or anything like that, but you're also kind of having a lower profile that people would accept you readily. So I think thinking about those things is just really important.
In the United States, our rights to freedom of speech and freedom of the press should be valued. Although not unique to the U.S., it is important for journalists of all identities to stay informed on the risk of reporting. To learn more about the work of the International Women's Media Foundation, please visit their website, IWMF.org. That's IWMF.org.
Millions of women and girls around the world suffer from a chronic disease called endometriosis, which can have a serious impact on quality of life. Block by Block reporter PLC spoke with three women in our region about their experiences with this condition.
Yep, yep, to the yep, yep. It's your girl, POC. Did you know that between 50 and 80% of women with pelvic pain have endometriosis, and up to 50% of women who are infertile have endometriosis? Scary, right? Trust me, I wouldn't wish this type of pain on anyone. Endometriosis is a condition where tissue similar to the lining of your uterus grows outside of your uterus, causing pain, infertility, and other challenges. I'm speaking up for about 190 million women worldwide, including myself. Behind every menstrual cycle, aka a period, is a person with a real story of strength, resilience, and wishing it would all go away. First, hear from Lauren Cornegay, a young professional who turned her pain into passion, creating unity and community, starting her nonprofit organization 5 years ago, Endo Black.
What inspired me is actually my own story. I was diagnosed March 18, 2011. I ended up being rushed to the hospital August of that same year after being diagnosed with 2 gallons of blood in my abdomen after a cyst ruptured. I then recognized that the diagnosis I had wasn't something like a small hurdle that you could just get over. My mother always taught me that if there is a void, you fill it. And if you're going to complain about something, you need to find a resolution. After being diagnosed, after coming back from the hospital, I took a deep dive to do research online about endometriosis, and it confused me more than what I was beforehand. And I felt like, what are the answers? I don't understand what's going on. So I built this Instagram page in 2015 in hopes of just, who are the people in this community? I felt like a Black unicorn because it was listed as a white woman's working disorder. So for so long, I was in this by myself. And then in 2015, I just felt like I needed to branch out. And that is how we ended up starting this whole community of women who have endometriosis. And in 2019, I decided to move forward with creating the nonprofit. Honestly, it's very difficult when we're living in this world and we're not knowing all of the different disorders that could possibly be affecting us. And we're just telling ourselves it's just period pain. Find us on endoblack.org.
During that time of month, what's better than peer-to-peer conversation? Journalist Sunny Morgan and I share a similar story. From age 11 up until present day, we both have been on a quest to find answers to this unwanted period pain. Sunny finds out that surgery is only one part of this complex mystery.
So I've had like a painful period since it started, honestly, around 11 or 12. And then I think just the entire time that I've dealt with the pain, I've never been able to diagnose it. I've gone to multiple doctors and they've always suggested the birth control route or just something to just like hide the issue. But recently I did have surgery, and the surgery that people who think they have endo will get is called a laparoscopy. And it's basically to diagnose endo. So I had the surgery actually less than a month ago. I'm just now recovering and feeling better from that surgery. And I had my post-op, and not to go super deep into what he found, but like one of the things which we talked about before I got the surgery was I could possibly have adeno and not endo. This is kind of leading me closer to that answer. I probably have the sister disease and not endo, but it's honestly all still the same. It just grows in a different way. And that this is a deeper conversation, in my opinion. I think women should have paid leave for their periods. But back to the symptoms. And even in my adult life, the cramps are kind of just on a scale of 1 to 10. It's always usually between 9 and 10 the first day or two of my period. And that's debilitating. And I hate living like that, which is why I've been on this quest to figure out what exactly the issue is so I can pinpoint it and try to live a healthier life or a better life. It's just so much to deal with. You're scared to do anything. You're scared to try anything. And you just kind of feel helpless. So that's kind of been my experience.
Sometimes a second opinion is best. Hear from Barbara Martin Ellis, a wife, a mother of two, a woman. Over the hill, the doctors tell her. Over the hill is where she needs to make it in order to be free of pain and menstrual cramps. She was told that menopause is the answer.
After my husband and I got married, we wanted to start a family. And for 3 years, we tried and started going to an endocrinologist and just trying to understand why I could not conceive. It felt very invasive. And every month when I would get my cycle, it was kind of a blow. And it just wasn't working. That was the first time I'd even heard the word endometriosis. And so I had surgery, a laparoscopy, a hysteroscopy. We had Clomid shots. There was a point where he was required to give me a shot in my buttocks. So, you know, kind of gave up on it, got a dog, moved on. And then, you know, fortunately found out that my son was on the way. And then because I wasn't sure that this would reoccur, we chose to have my second son pretty close. So they're 17 months apart. And then in my mid-40s, those really, really bad cramps returned. I had a new gynecologist at the time, and she kept saying, don't worry about it. You know, you're about to go into menopause. It'll be over the next year. Don't worry about it. Yeah, I mean, but this is painful and this hurts. Don't worry about it. So finally, I left her and went to someone else. And right now, I'm in the process of getting the results from, you know, an endometrial biopsy, getting an ultrasound done just to see what's going on. I just turned 54. So apparently it's a lifelong journey.
For Block by Block, this is your girl, POC.
In recent years, many pregnant people in Black communities have been opting to have midwives or doulas aid them in the birthing process rather than giving birth in a hospital. As part of his series on different forms of justice, my co-host, David Chaney Jr., brings us a story about birthing justice, which looks at why some people are returning to traditional practices as a way to combat racial disparities in modern medicine.
Being a doula or midwife goes back thousands of years. Recently, this traditional practice of bringing life into the world has increased due to health disparities in the Black community. Falami Irvine is a retired educator and former doula who shares her journey of advocacy for Black mothers, babies, and communities for over 20 years. It started with her going to a workshop back in 1999. Falami tells how she studied midwifery and the mentoring she received from other women in the community.
Not knowing the history, and a lot of people now that's coming down this path, they don't know about the elder midwives. See, when you come on the elder midwives, one of the requirements for Mama Shafia doula program, which I took doula training under her, one of the requirements is that you had to read the books about these Southern women. Okay, for example, why it's so important, back in Alabama in the 1900s, there were over more than 4,000 midwives. And in those rural areas, that's all you had was midwives. We couldn't go to the Shiny Hospital. My mother sitting in a dining room, born 1937 in Philadelphia, she was delivered by a midwife. That's who my mother was delivered by. And so when we look at the disparities, some of these midwives could not maybe like read and write, but they had a close connection with God. They had a really close connection with the Creator. They would go into the closet, they would pray. And she talks about in the book how she didn't know what to do. And sometimes I just went and I prayed and I asked for guidance, I asked for direction. So that was the key. They really believed.
Midwives and doulas have always been part of the local community. These women have provided comfort, instruction, and guidance during the pregnancy and afterwards.
When you deal with birthing, you didn't just deal with having the baby right there. They dealt with you from the community. These were women who was on the deaconess board. So y'all kind of dealt with each other inside the church. And then it didn't just stop. Once that baby was born, everybody, she was reverend in the community. Hi, Mama Shafia, Mama Sosa. You were part of the community. You weren't just somebody that was here and you was just a number. You were part of the community. So it goes bigger than just me being at your birth. I see these babies after their birth.
Although midwifery has such a rich history, it comes with some challenges. Currently in Pennsylvania, the infant mortality rate for Black babies is 2 times more than the state rate. That's just the surface layer of challenges. Falami explains some of the challenges she experienced firsthand as a doula.
Some of the biggest challenges here is that Philadelphia is pretty much a service city. And I really felt like there's a lot of things that are monopolized. Like most of the birthing programs here in Philadelphia are monopolized by women who are really not from the community. And they have a whole monopoly on how the systems work. And then there's people who don't want to come together, not understanding collaboration, that we are our sister's keeper, that they work against one another.
Falami shares a mosaic of experiences that Black women have encountered when visiting the doctor for prenatal and maternal care. These interactions have played a significant role in health disparities among Black women.
You have two women and they're both pregnant. They can be 28 years old. And they always say, well, she has high blood pressure, she's obese, she's this, she's that. This is what they'll do. And this is what they did to me. I'm going to give you an example. I'm pregnant. I'm 28 with my first child. Are you going to keep it? Mom, these are the questions. Are you going to keep the baby? You're like in your last year of school. Is this something you think you really want to do? Okay. Nobody mentions childbirth education. No one says, are you going to breastfeed? Now I'm a young white girl and I'm 28 years old. Listen, we had this excellent childbirth education here. Your insurance pays for it. We had this here. Congratulations, Mom. Hi, how are you? We're so glad to have you here. Oh, good. Mom, we're just glad to. We're thankful that you're here.
Because of the injustices that Black women have faced during their pregnancies, legislation has been introduced in Congress. The Black Maternal Health Monopolies Act is designed to improve maternal health with a specific focus on racial ethnic minority groups, veterans, and other vulnerable populations. Falami continues to advocate for women and shares this message for the community.
We have to educate ourselves. You know, just the same way I tell young mothers all the time, when you went on your prom, you knew the material. You knew how you wanted your hair laid. You knew your nail color. You put a lot of work into the prom jacket and the whole entire. Put that work into this unborn. We can change this stuff in our communities, I think, by getting people that are really seasoned. And I think that once people get into a mindset that we have to work together. And until we work together with a lot of things, things are not going to improve. And you can bring a million hospitals, you can build them up, you can make them the state of the art, but it's the people. It's the people. So you can't train the heart.
For more information about health disparities among Black women in maternity care, please check out March for Dimes website. This is David Cheney Jr., Block by Block.
Wow, David, what a powerful story. Listen, since we have you here in the studio, I'd love to dig a little bit deeper. You know, from what I heard from the story, clearly access to midwives and doulas is available in Philadelphia. But what do you think the biggest barriers are?
So one of the biggest barriers, as we listened to in the story, is engagement between patient and healthcare provider. And so a lot of times when you have these patients who go in, who are seeking help, they're seeking advice, they're seeking comfort in a lot of cases, right? And they get the total opposite because of they're Black or they're a woman, or it could be a class issue, you know, oh, you're from this part of the city or you're from this neighborhood. So it's all those things that's a mixture, but it all goes back to engagement. So now I'm in the door, that's access, but how do you treat me once I'm in the room? How do you treat me, you know, with or without support? Are you providing resources for me? So that's the main thing, making sure that there's engagement and that is good engagement, that is significant engagement, and that is really making sure that the patient is getting what they need and that it can help them be better and help them advocate for themselves for the next time they meet with the healthcare provider.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that. And I'm so happy that you're in the studio with us tonight.
Thank you.
Block by Block is produced by Kaiser Carter, Oscar Castro, Mish Katsaras, Barbara Martin Ellis, Thomas Hagen, Sunny Morgan, Sherry Pennington, POC, Shania Weich, and us,
David Cheney Jr.
and Jen DeVore. Shania Weich is also our board operator tonight.
Brad Linder is Radio News Managing Editor for WPPM. Peter Liu is Radio Operations Manager. And Allison Durham is WPPM's Radio Program Manager.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode of Block by Block, featuring more stories about issues affecting life in the Philly region. And you can find past episodes of the show on PhillyCam's SoundCloud, Apple Podcast, Spotify, and wherever else you find your podcast.
Thanks for listening.